Yo, and welcome to the 63rd episode of Lake of Rage, a Pokemon trading card game podcast. I'm your host, as always, Kevin Clementi, a.k.a. Mellow underscore Magikarp. And I'm joined today by a very special temporary guest host. Joining us for the third time, I believe it is, we have the man who is fresh off of a top eight at Milwaukee Regionals, Tord Reklev.
Hello.
So I got a very special episode for y'all today. We're going to talk to Tord a little bit about his run in Milwaukee, how he came up with the absolutely broken, new, never-before-seen deck that he brought, how the tournament went for him, as well as how things are going to change for NAIC after Milwaukee's slightly unpredicted results. So, Tord, I think the very first thing I want to ask, though, based off of the unpredicted results, we'll get into NAIC in more detail, but which had the less likely top eight or the more surprising top eight, Melbourne or Milwaukee?
Well, honestly, on a personal level, I feel like Melbourne had a more surprising top eight because it's really difficult to get eight of the same deck in top eight, no matter how good a deck is. So, but it was cool to see like some more diversity in Milwaukee. I know like the Duraludon and the Blizzard deck was a surprise to many, but if you like from the Japanese meta game and also like the online meta game, it shouldn't be that crazy of a surprise. The decks are not bad, right? I mean, obviously they have their flaws, but with the right matchups, right text, right metagame, obviously you could see that they were both able to go the distance, right? So I think that was pretty cool. And yeah.
Blissey Miltank's an interesting one. When you bring up the Japanese meta, it seems like a deck that is A, incredibly popular, and B, incredibly successful in Japan, as well as online tournaments, and yet no one seemed to hype it up. We constantly put it in this tier 2, or if you're Henry Brand, Amoeba tier level of deck. And I'm curious to see if things are going to change, but we'll get into the future stuff. I want to get back to your run in Milwaukee, the first tournament in Astral Radiance outside of Australia. That's important because it was about four times the size, which is pretty relevant. And it was only a couple hours away from NAIC, which will be the last tournament in the Astral Radiance format. Starting fast, ending fast. So you played Palkia Inteleon, correct?
I did.
How did you come up with that, and what made you lean towards playing the deck that, like you said, it took up 8 out of 8 slots in Melbourne? That seems like something that you shouldn't automatically gravitate towards. So how'd you kind of come up with the idea of, like, this is the deck that I'm going to play, I'm not afraid of the counters, you know, all that other kind of stuff? How'd you come up with the deck?
Well, honestly, I usually go for what I feel like is the most consistent deck, or the deck that has the most even matchup spread, right? Like, basically, I'm trying to go towards some sort of deck that I feel like gives me the best chance of doing well in any given tournament. And like, Palkia's just seemed really, really strong to me, and I knew I was going to play against a lot of Palkia, right? So I tried to find a consistent way to beat it. But you can build Palkia in like a lot of different ways as well, right? Like, you have the turbo version that does one thing really well, and then you have the Inteleon version that can be teched out, have all these different tech cards, answers to everything you can try to throw at them, theoretically at least, right? So it was a pretty hard deck to straight up counter, unless you wanted to focus your whole archetype around trying to counter it, right? It was, for example, when I tried to test Urshifu against Palkia, it was not a lot of cards I could splash into there to beat it. And you might say, yo, what about Serora? Or what about Raikou, right? But they're just not enough against Palkia. Serora can be countered by Tool Gemmon, so then you need Tool Scrapper as well. And Raikou doesn't do anything else than stabilize for one turn, and it trades evenly. So that also doesn't really give you any sort of advantage. So, like, but now I was struggling to beat Palkia, and I was thinking, you know what? If I just bring this deck myself, maybe I'll figure out if someone else figure out a good way to beat it. And through the tournament, it turns out that most people didn't figure out a good way to beat it either. So I had a pretty okay time playing it.
I love what you said about Raikou and the Zero Aura as well, obviously, but like that was something that I said on last week's episode, and I keep having to tell people, and I assume you get the same thing where like people will DM you before a tournament, like, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? What do you think of this? And it's like, the Raikou is a terrible counter. If your two prizer KOs a two prizer and then gets KO'd in return, you're just playing extra jank in your deck. You're not actually beating anything.
So, yeah, like you're stabilizing, right? But you need something in your deck. Like your Raikou can buy you a turn of time, right? Because it's easy enough to get in play. But you still need something in your deck to gain an advantage again, right? So you can't just lean on Raikou the whole way, because then that won't actually do it.
So I'm kind of curious. You mentioned like, okay, Palkia, trying to find something that beats it. Do you think your version of Palkia wins the mirror match? Or do you beat the turbo version only and the Inteleon version's a coin flip? Do you beat all of them? Or do you just get lucky?
Nah, the thing is, right, I tried to make a deck that was a pretty neutral going into a random meta game, right? So I wanted to have like reasonably answers against most things, but there's nothing crazy in the list. The only thing that's kind of crazy is the Cheryl. Otherwise, the list I played was very vanilla, I would say. It just focused really hard on setting up. That's why it plays the Ford of Rita and also the Luminion. It gives you a lot of outs to the turn one VIP pass if you were to go second. The Starmie was in there in case I were to go up against Blissey, right? Also pretty decent against Miltank, or like against Draludon, I mean. As you can deal with the first Arceus immediately, so they don't have time to charge two Draludon VMAX at least. So when I was up against Draludon, I was able to take out the Arceus immediately, and then I just had to get through the one VMAX somehow. But it usually still turns into a game of I play Roxanne. Did you hit a healing card or support or whatever? No, I win. Oh, you hit it? Oh, I guess I lose. So
I'm curious about that Roxanne real quick. I mean, not just exclusively the Roxanne, but how good was Roxanne for you? Is it a card that you're like, yes, this is 100% a staple in the deck? Or was it a card where you're like, it was pretty good, it's probably worth considering?
Well, do I want to be honest here? You know what? Roxanne is like the best card in the set, and it's not close, and should be probably in almost any deck. But
when you say any deck, is that like
if you're behind, it's a really good comeback card.
So when you're saying like it should be in any deck, it's okay, not just Inteleon decks.
No, like Eddie, which was on stream, he was playing it in Mew even, because I think it's a really strong card, just in general. So like he was wondering if he should play it in Mew, and he came and asked me, and we tested a few games, and you know what? It was really good, and especially against Inteleon, because you just like camp with it, right? Just like you would camp with Marnie against Inteleon, you could camp with the Roxanne, and then you could play Roxanne, and you could try to scam some games that way. And it's kind of effective. Two cards is not a lot of cards, so it's very easy for a opponent if they need, say, two cards to close out the game, an attachment and a boss. It's usually what most games need to be finished. A Roxanne will usually deny that. So even if your opponent finds a supporter or a way out, they will probably miss another piece. Even through an Inteleon engine, they will probably miss another piece, right? A Gate, a Drizella off the two cards and finds a boss, but then don't have the energy, or the other way around. So Roxanne is a really good comeback card, and a lot of times you can intentionally get behind, so you can use the Roxanne before your opponent, so you can like come back and steamroll. I didn't do it myself, but I know like Fabian had like he passed a turn when he could take a KO just because he didn't want to be Roxanne, and then Roxanne back, and then he just steamrolled the whole game. So like Roxanne is a really good card.
Is that one of those interactions that you think is people are going to finally start to catch up on, of like, oh, if I go down to three prize cards remaining, I might just lose next turn, I'm not ready for that? Or do you think it's going to take a while for people to get used to, you know, the reset stamp and mechanic again?
Yeah, we haven't had it in format for a long time, right? So It's definitely something people are not used to playing around anymore. It's a really big deal. Because up until this point, we didn't have any cards in the format that actually that you had to think about before you went down on prices. Like, okay, you had Baby Molters, right? So you could maybe consider that one. But like in general, there was not really much that you would want to play around by not taking knockouts. But now you suddenly have a card again, right? So you might want to boss around and set up more damage on the opponent's field before you start taking knockouts instead, which is pretty cool. Like, it's really nice to have a card that can punish four board states, because that elevates the skill gap between players as well, which I think is a cool thing, right? Not everyone might think that, but I think that's really cool. Because I like to focus on board states and building a good field before you go in to take prices. And I like any punish card is a good card in the format, I think.
That's why I love Pikarom, being able to build that board state, having that stamp come back. It's it always felt good. Like, well, you can do whatever you want to my hand. I'm going to play off my board the rest of the game.
Yeah, like playing off the board is very underestimated. When your hand can get dealt with, right? Like you're sitting there with like one prize card left, 10 cards in hand, feeling like nothing can go wrong, and then you lose your hand, and then you realize, oh, actually, I still need a card or two to finish off this game, right? And now you don't have a hand anymore, and you can do comebacks against people.
So another thing, as I look at your list, there's one very obvious difference between your list and then the group that Riley Holbert and all of them played, and then we also saw like, I don't know what they're called, but like the squad from NA and their list. And it was, you played the four Aritas and everyone else played between 0 to 1. How did you come up with four Aritas? I mean, it gets a Pokemon and an item. That's an awful card, right? Why would you ever want to play that?
That is true. But it's just really, really good in the Intellion deck in general, because you get, at the very least, you get two cards, right? You get to pick up the Drizzle, and you get to pick up an item card. So, like, essentially, if you remember back to teammates, or twins, or whatever, that card was also very, very good, but it was only activated when your opponent took a KO, right? In this deck, you can use it anytime you want. It's just really, really good. And when you play a research, if you hit like two or three pieces you need, then you're usually really happy with how the research turned out, and you're okay discarding cards to make that happen, right? But with Rita, you can just grab the pieces you need for turn directly. What makes this especially good in this deck is that you can pick up Bucket most times, which grabs double water, which is something you basically always need for turn. And then you have Greninja in play, which draws two, right? So you indirectly have card draw and hand attachment, fuel for your V-Star ability, and board development, in that you can pick up, say, Drizzle, I can pick up another card again. And it also conserves all your ball cards, which lets you play like thinner lines of those as well. Since you can grab the water Pokemon directly with the Rita, right? So you can save out an Incense, for example, because you can grab Palkia V-Star directly, stuff like that, or Inteleon directly. So you're saving out on, you're getting more space in your deck, you're just getting more consistent, and like you're just chaining Rita into each other is really solid. You basically, as soon as you started evolving and starting spamming those Iridas, there is nothing that can really go wrong anymore. You can't Marnie into that hand, resource into that hand. You just have a chain of Iridas going. And I feel very comfortable playing the game that way. And then rather take like the random draws off of the Greninja instead. Because then you have the best of both worlds. So you have a little bit of card draw. And then depending on what you draw, you can fill out what you're missing with the search cards again.
That makes a lot of sense. Another thing that appears to be missing from your list, I'm going to say the word missing, and you're going to immediately tell me why it's not missing, it's just bad. There's zero cross switchers in your list. Instead, you've just got good old fashioned boss. What made you choose to go against the cross switchers that seem to be so prevalent in every other Palkia list?
Honestly, cross switcher is pretty good. I kind of missed that. But it was just a matter of space. I might want to add them later, honestly. I think they're really good. Maybe if I had tried more games with the cross switchers, I would have wanted to go more in that direction. Like, you can definitely play the deck without them, though. It's not a crazy big deal. You get your deck a little bit more consistent, but you're losing out on power level. So that's a trade-off. But I think they're good. They're really good for power level in the deck. And it's nice to be able to, like, Melanie cross switcher, for example. At the same time, that's really good. You can cross switch your Roxanne, that's like super strong. But they do take up a little bit more space, so you're losing out on tricks, for example.
Okay, so it's one of those things where it's just a matter of 3 to 4 cards is potentially too much, as opposed to the card's not good.
Yeah, like 2 cross switches is the effect of 1 boss, right? So you can play 1 boss, you can play 2 cross switcher, and you have the same amount of guesting, right? But you can't boss and use another support in the same turn. So there's that, right? The switch effect is actually kind of cool sometimes, because Palkia has 2 retreat, so that could also come in handy. I don't want to say the card is bad, though. I do like it. Maybe I will try it more in the future.
Are you going to be doing a lot of testing in this upcoming week, or do you feel like you've got something in the back of your mind?
No, I'll still try my best to see what I can test and be able to come up with. But I feel like I have a pretty good grasp of the metagame. So there's also just a few days left, right, until NAIC. And I always tell people that you should try to lock in something as early as possible. So I probably don't want to swing too much from the deck I think is really good.
One more question about Palkia, and this one might ruffle some feathers, we'll see. But did you see the list that, like, the NA squad played for Palkia? The Bradner, Rahul, I'm pretty sure John, and I'm not sure if Franco was on the same 60 or not. But it was the 4 battle VIP pass, a 3-3-1-1, I believe, or 3-3-2. Inteleon line with the Zigzagoon and the Mew. What are your thoughts on the battle VIP pass heavy and the 3 Sobbles? Is there anything in there that interests you, or do you just think that was good players playing a good deck?
Like, and the 3 Sobbles, I don't really like it. I can see where they're coming from, because you usually build a board where you only have 2 Sobbles anyway, right? Because you use 1 consistency spot for Greninja, regardless, right? So your field doesn't usually have spots for more than 2 Sobbles. But, like, turn 1 Keep Calling is still really good to just grab all the Sobbles, because if 1 get knocked out, you have the rest of them on board. And that's really good. If you're playing against any matchup as well, and you prize 1 Sobble, and 1 of them gets knocked out, that's also really annoying. So I can't really stand behind only playing 3 of them. It's messing up your Keep Calling and you're getting price issues. So I don't really like that, but I can see where they're coming from. To save a spot, right? I also think heavy VIP pass is like, okay. I can see where they're coming from there as well, because if you go first, right, you much rather have a VIP pass in your hand than Irida, correct? But if you're going second again, then you probably much rather want that card to be Rida, so you can grab a Pokemon too. It was also pretty light on supporters. I think you're allowed to play approximately 10 of them these days in Inteleon Engines. That's what I've been playing in Urshifu for the longest time, and I feel like if when I go above or below that, then it's starting to get a little bit funky, but around 10. So I feel I think Liz was a little bit light on supporters. Might remember wrong, but though it definitely had space for a couple more Iridas over the heavy VIP pass count. So I like that direction more, and also like to play the Luminion to guarantee to get it. I felt that was like more space efficient, but I can see both approaches working. It's not a big deal. I know the Japanese list has been playing heavy VIP pass for a long time as well, so it's definitely a completely fine approach that also works.
So as you mentioned that, I want to kind of get into some of the tournament stuff, maybe some of the specifics of the rounds, and one of them is that Luminion that you talked about. So heading into the specifics of the tournament, how many games did having Luminion lose you, if any?
I don't think a single game, actually, but it didn't win. They did win me a ton of games. Like, I had so many funky starts that could only be saved by Luminion. Like, a hand that just looks absolutely atrocious, but it has one ball out, right? And that means Luminion into VIP pass and another basic. So I can turn that one basic into three basics. And obviously that's a huge deal, because if I bench one Palkia and it gets bossed, I lose, right? That's it. That's game over. But if I bench two of them and a sub ball, I get to play the game. So I think Luminion was a really big deal that allowed me to set up and play more games. It's also really cool because with Roxanne in the format, right? Usually what you need to close out games, like we talked about, is a boss or so, right? And if you have a little fish swimming around in your deck, all your quick balls are out for that boss as well. So not only level balls or incense or drizzle are out anymore, but all the quick balls, so they're normally dead. And that's the ball you play the most of. So it's kind of nice having that ball also be an out when you lose your hand, so that you can close out the game.
So moving forward, do you think that fish is just like 100% the move over Crobat, or do you have any interest in testing out that Crobat that like Riley Holbert and his group had played?
Crobat is also a reasonable option. I also like the fish because if you were to open with it, the fish can swim away right back into the deck. Crobat cannot, right? If you were to discard the support Pokemon as well, so either Crobat or Luminion, you can get it back with Nessa. And I really like to play Nessa in the deck. I guess it's like another card that's debatable, because a lot of people want to play the Rod over the Nessa again. But if you do play the Nessa, you can get back the Luminion if you were to discard it. And that plays around Echo Horn pretty well. So I like that aspect of it too. Just it being a water Pokemon is really nice. You can also pick it up with Irida for whatever reason you have, but you can you can do that, but you have it available for next turn. Like, there are weird cases where the attack is pretty good, like just in general, because you can bench it and charge it with Palkia and then attack and shuffle it away, and then you can promote a Sobble. So you can like, even without an Intellion play, you can play the single prize game with it. Say if you need to KO or Regieleki or whatever, you can do that with Luminion in a Finch.
So you heard it here first. Tord, the best player in the world, is pro fish, as you should all be.
Yeah, I mean, we love fish, right? So you have to play the fish. The fish was super good. I debated it a little bit before the tournament, but I figured I'd much rather be safe than sorry, and I was definitely safe. So thank you, fish.
So now let's go back to round number one. So you're sitting down. You are a couple weeks removed from Vancouver, where you just got your second place finish. You know, absolutely killed it, right? How are you feeling, though? New format, technically new country, I guess. One of your like six countries in 4 weeks, or however many you've been to. How are you feeling?
Yeah, exactly.
How are you feeling, and what are you thinking before round one starts?
I'm feeling really sleepy and like super jet lagged, because I arrived like Thursday evening, and only had that one day to readjust, and it was definitely not enough. So I wasn't feeling the best. Motivation was kind of low. So I also started out kind of rough. I was 2-0-2. Could have played faster, I guess. Ended up tying a couple games. Definitely wasn't playing at my absolute top there. And then I ended up... I started winning games again after looking at my score and deciding I had to try to get it together. But then I found a mirror some rounds later. I think it was against Poet Larsen. And he played really well, and I made a couple of like critical mistakes that ended me costing me that that mirror matchup in both games. So from there, like all my remaining matches was kind of a roller coaster. I was drawing pretty poorly. I still felt like I played pretty well from that point on, at least, but. I was drawing pretty poorly, but somehow in the final moments of game three in each match, my opponent just suddenly didn't have the card they needed, right? Like, always missed boss somehow or something else silly. It really, I don't know, that's why I wrote that I felt like I had the sickest plot armor, because I felt like I was out of this tournament so many times during day one already. But they never had it somehow, so I advanced. It was kind of crazy.
So what's going through your head? Because we've all been in those situations, right? You play out the game in your head a couple turns in advance, and you're like, they always win before I win. It's like, what are you thinking? How do you not get down on yourself? Or how do you not make misplays because you're like, well, I'm going to lose anyway, so why does it matter? Like, how do you get through that stuff to still play well?
I'm like, it's always about playing to your outs, right? So I was playing to my outs. I was going for win conditions. We're like, okay, I have to play risky here. So the only way I win is if I go for this route and then miss on the following turn. And that happened like way more than it should. Like, you can argue that, like, since I was drawing probably in the beginning of the game, right? So if you look at the game as a whole, it wasn't that crazy to come out on top, but it just felt like really insane to me because I was already given the information that I was down bad in the game. So it was just such a roller coaster of a tournament. I haven't had that happen in a long time. I had a lot of close games before, but it just felt like really unreal. A couple of those matches I had, what happened in those. There was also, like, in my last round of Swiss, there was a couple like critical game errors happening because, like, we're both tired and my opponent's been like drawing extra cards off of Greninja under Pat and stuff, and that definitely like messed up our games. Like, even games my opponent was ahead in, and it was pretty silly. So a very weird tournament run for me overall, especially during the first day. Day two I felt like was much more solid. Day two I felt like I played better. I still felt tired, but it wasn't as bad. But I felt like I was much more on point during the second day of play than during the first day.
So before we get into day two, what did you end day one's record at?
Day one, I actually ended at 6-1-2, which is a pretty good score, but I had to win the last two or three matches. So I felt kind of down, like mentally for a few rounds. But I was thinking, you know what, I can still have a reasonably good score here if I just win out, and then I managed to do it somehow though.
Nah, somehow's easy.
Yeah, I mean, I did play a pretty good deck, right? And I knew the matchups reasonably well too. So, nah, it was just a roller coaster overall. It was a lot of fun though, for sure.
So now we're heading into day two. On Sunday, you're 6-1-2. You're ahead of all the 19-point people. You're ahead of all the people who ID'd safely in. You know, all those noobs, right? How are you approaching day two? Are you saying, I'm winning this entire tournament? Are you like, I just want my money and then I'm going to go catch up on my sleep schedule for NAIC. Like, where are you mentally placing yourself, or where are you putting that pressure on yourself?
No, I'm mentally looking for how many points do I need for top eight, right? So how do I maximize my chances here? If I, like, if I get, if I'm last place in day two, that doesn't matter to me. It's like I'm either top eighting or I don't care. I just want to continue playing in the tournament. That's where my mental state is at. So I'm doing my best to make that happen. But like with that goal, if you aim for top eight, you probably get top 16, right? If you know what I mean. So it doesn't hurt trying your best no matter what, right? And just aiming as high as you can. But I guess there's like places where you can be like, oh, as last round of Swiss, if I ID, I'm guaranteed top 16. If I play, then I could make it, right? But I would always play in those cases if that's the question. I just want to play Pokemon and always see how far I can take it. I don't really mind. That's, and as you can see, we have so many tournaments and they've all been like so rapid as well, right? So I always want to see how far I can take it.
Are there any matches that stood out to you in day two of like, this one went really well, or this one almost went really poorly, or I made a super cool play here? Like, is there anything that stands out in those day twos, those rounds 10 through 14, that's like, oh, this was a really good one?
Ooh, I mean, the best one was the one on stream, luckily enough.
It was really good.
Yeah, and I was up against Rowan, we were both like talking before the match began. We were saying, okay, we really don't want to tie this because then we're both out, right? And we both want top eight. He was kind of okay with like getting the tie for the top 16, but of course we'd rather have the game finish, right? So I was asking if he wanted some sort of gentleman's agreement, if that was what he was looking for, but he was at nah, because like top 16, the tie was fine for that as well. And it's also awkward to say find a win condition on prices when obviously he has the faster deck again, right? So that would be something I might not want to be looking into either. It's also awkward to do that because then if both players know that's something you could actively play towards, right, and try to time it so that a game that normally would have gone the other way is something you can just try to take a price lead, right, instead of trying to actually win the game. And then the opponent has to concede just because you have technically have the lead and that's what you agreed on, right? So you don't really want to be playing into that type of thing either.
I have a question. Do they, so gentlemen's agreements are non-enforceable but legal, right? That's like a known quantity, exactly. And if not known quantity, anyone going to a regional should know it, because if you make day two, there's a very realistic chance that your opponent is going to proposition you, blah, blah, blah. On stream, yes. Is there anything about on stream that makes it a little bit weirder to make a gentleman's agreement? Or is it just like, I'm just playing the game and there happens to be a camera on it?
Nah, it's still fine though. Like obviously the stream don't know what's going on if you do a gentleman's agreement, right? But I guess like that's something you could tell the judges so that they can tell the casters so that people know. But as you said though, it's not enforceable by any means. It's just like a moral code, right? That you could do. Like you both players would have to agree though first, right? And then I think you should stick to it, of course, if you agree to it. But if the players don't agree to it beforehand, then obviously there shouldn't be any need to feel bad about it afterwards. But cool thing though, like we both really wanted to finish, so we played at the speed of light game three, so that we was sure we could finish. I think we finished before the timer ran out, so we didn't even need plus three turns. That was kind of sick. Pretty cool stuff.
I do have to, as a quick story, my first day two at Portland, I was on a win and into top eight, And my opponent offers the gentleman's agreement going into game three. They're playing control. I'm playing Zoro Garb. And, you know, they offer it. And I'm like, yeah, sure. Let's go off prizes. And they're like, no, like, obviously not. And they just throw out all these ridiculous things of like, you know, just all these things of like, how do you measure that? Like, where's this going? And by the time we got set up, there was like no actual agreement that we ever actually got to. And it didn't matter. I literally got handlocked without attacking. Like, I dead drew so hard. It was miserable. But it was
I see.
It was an interesting experience. So did you have anyone tell you, speaking of that game, so game two it was, you boss-stalled Rowan's Genesect and there was no way for Rowan to move it. And
that was actually not it. I think that was what the casters thought happened, right?
Oh, that's but yeah, that's what they that said, was, yeah.
Yeah, that was not how game two went down at all.
Oh, wait, so, no, we need the inside scoop. Give it to us.
Okay, I tried to explain it in the winner's interview after, but like basically I was about to do my full combo on him, right? I was about to like grab my four prizes and Roxanne pat him and, you know, just set myself up to like kill him on the following turn again. And he didn't have time to see that happen. And with the resources he was down, he had no time for that. So when he saw that I had to struggle a little bit to figure out the sequencing, then he was just like, you know what? I'm conceding. Let's go to the next one. There was no like boss stall or anything involved here. It was just straight price trading, and he didn't like his position, so he conceded. So he went to the next one. The problem here, though, this is not his fault. But I had an incense in hand, and he knew I had an incense in hand. I also had Rizal, and like a developed board, so it should be really easy for me to do the whole combo on him, but I had price matched the Dealing Centellion in my last four prizes. This is information he did not have, so pulling off this full combo was a little bit harder than he thought, right? So if he had given me two more minutes, then he might have seen that I might have missed the full combo on him, and he could have had a chance. In almost all cases, I think his concede was pretty fair there. Like, he explained to me that if I just did the normal thing on him, he would need double heads of Silene into heads on Flipcatcher, and that was given that he drew out of Roxanne Pat. So that sounded pretty unlikely to me as well. So his concede seemed pretty fair to me, and then we would have time for game three.
Okay, so that's something I mean, it makes sense. So when you like lay everything out, it's like 100% like, okay, I get the scoop. But that was not what we were told watching it at all. So it's super interesting to hear what actually happened there.
Yeah, no, I also got the memo that the casters didn't really know what was going on, because like I didn't even start my turn, so my turn looked pretty weak already, right? I was about to set it up and do my thing, right? But he conceded before I started doing that. So from like a board state position, but he knew, right? He knew what was coming.
Of course.
Board state position, it looks like I was in real bad here, but I was actually doing fine that game. And I was doing better than him. If you checked his discard pile, he was not doing that great.
I do love, and I don't know if anyone's told you this, but the casters immediately said that you scooped, and they were like congratulating Rowan on the top eight, or the fact that he was going to make cut, without realizing that Rowan was the one that scooped the whole time.
Yeah, that's pretty funny, though. It's pretty funny. It just goes to show that like there's a lot of depth to the game still, and I think that's pretty cool, right? You can turn a game around in an instant.
No, I agree. I think this format feels very good right now. Like, there's just like a lot of stuff that can happen, and it's less of a dread end for 270 three times and I win the game, right?
Oh, my favorite.
Crushing Hammer, boss, dread end, GGs. Top eight. What did you play against in top eight?
So in top eight, I ended up actually facing the eventual winner of the tournament. I was playing Duraludon and Arceus. That was pretty.
I was gonna say, you play no special energies. You should just win, right?
Yeah, well, you would think so, right?
I will explain. So the Arceus Duraludon deck, really friendly guy, by the way, just want to put that out there. I was happy to see him win in the end. The Arceus Duraludon deck can play with a really low bench, meaning that Palkia's damage output isn't really high. You usually have like one on the bench, maybe two, but usually one. That means that Palkia's damage output is about 180, and 180 is pretty easily healable. So you can play Stadium, heal 30, and then you can High Proportion and heal another 120. So you can basically negate the whole attack that was done by Palkia. So you need to attack again, right? So that just buys you a free turn. And every time the Duraludon attacks, it's essentially taking at least one prize, right? That's absolute best case for the Palkia deck. That means that it's trying to two-shot the Palkia, or it's killing a single prize Pokemon straight up, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. You're either like, if you're two-shotting a Palkia, you're taking a prize every turn, essentially.
Exactly, right? So you, every attack, you're getting essentially one worth of a prize, right? And every time you attack with, say, Palkia, and threatening two-shot, you're technically taking one and a half, but if you are getting reset, right, of the healing, then you lose a turn. So it's a pretty close matchup, but with the healing, especially if the Duraludon can heal twice, then you do lose the prize trade as long as they just attack each turn. And that's not that hard to do. And then you also have the boss problems. If you get bossed on your Palkia before it evolves, then they take two, right? And then you're definitely losing the prize trade here. So it's not that easy of a prize trade to do with Palkia. So if you get the turn two attack off with Arceus, like, it's almost a little bit of if with Arceus or a Ludon deck, right? Because it's not known to be the most consistent deck in the world. There are definitely some things that can go wrong for you when you play it, but when you set up and you play well, you draw well, then it's really hard to stop sometimes. So yeah, in the matchup, I was using Starmie for everything it was worth.
Mm-hmm.
With Starmie, I can knock out the Arceus after the first charge. And normally you have to two-shot it, right? But with Starmie, I could put a lot of pressure by just immediately killing the Arceus, either the basic or the V-Star, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you would think that is like amazing, right? But it just gets knocked out straight back again by the Duraludon tanking choices. So it just trades evenly. But what it does, right, is that it blocks the second Duraludon from getting set up. And that's the big part here. Because if you can block the second Duraludon from getting energies, or even hit play at all, right, then I only need to power through that one VMAX somehow, and then I will be able to win the game. So essentially how both games played out, right, or like all three games, we played three games. Game one, I come into a spot where I hit the Duraludon VMAX with my Roxanne, put on Pat, because I had gotten the inside scoop from Fabian earlier that he played Elegos in his deck. So I needed to put down Pat to block the Elegos from finding the boss's order he needed for game again, right? So I put on Pat, I put on Roxanne, I hit, I look at him, do you got it? And he just flashes me an Ultra Ball and two dead cards. So the Pat blocked the Elegos and I win the first game. So I was pretty happy with that. I was like, okay, we have a strat. We just need to hit and pat, okay? that's how we get him.
Winning game one always feels so good.
It does, right? It does. Second game, he has a pretty weak opener. It looks like, at least, right, to me. Opens Duraludon, benches Arceus, attached double turbo. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. That's like three or four card hand. And now I got a little bit baited because I naturally opened my pat, you know? So I was like, okay, I need this pat for my Roxanne play at the end of the game to block his Eldegoss, right? If the game just plays it out normally. But what if I play it now and he just misses the attack next turn and I just win because I can, I get my turn just now instead of later again, right? So that would be a way to just steal the game immediately. And the greed got the best of me, and I played it. And what do you know? It has to counter state him in hand and Arceus. So it didn't really pan out. In the end, I end up doing the same play, but I don't have the pet anymore. So I Roxanne him to 2, smack into the Duraludon, and he gets a bolt for Eldegoss for boss. So I lose game 2. Which is like fair enough, right? I had put all my eggs in one basket in the early game by playing the pet, hoping he breaked off of it, and it didn't pan out. So heading into game 3. I end up pricing my Roxanne, and that's, you know, that's my game plan. So, without my Roxanne, I knock out an Arceus, I still miss it, and I don't really have any good way of combating the deck anymore. Oh, I also miss, like, the turn 1 Palkia in play, which was a problem.
So you're just, like, giving them an entire extra turn, then?
Yeah, so even if I went first, since I missed the Palkia, it was basically, like, going second again, so it didn't really matter. And then he got like an extra supporter set up and had a good start, of course. So that was an issue. And with the Roxanne priced as well, the end of game 3 was definitely the most convincing game for him in his favor. I was pretty checkmated the last 3 turns. I tried my best, but it wasn't really much of an out there. I was a turn behind, and I also had my comeback option in the prices, so it was really difficult to do much there. And then ended up losing. I think, like, in retrospect, if I kept the pat, so I could jam down the pat in the second game together with Roxanne, given that everything else in the game happened at the same, might have been able to steal that one too, because I'm pretty sure you just got a ball out of the Roxanne, but it's hard to speculate on that later, right? But I think maybe I got a little bit greedy in the second game. And it was completely fair, though. I had a lot of fun playing those games and like thinking about them afterwards.
That's one of those ones where hindsight seems like, well, if I hold the path, I'm fine. But on the flip side, if you lose the game and they just go Arceus Starbirth without throwing down a stadium because they didn't have the counter stadium, you're in the exact same boat, right?
Yeah, I mean, if he doesn't have the counter stadium, so then he probably can't attack with Arceus next turn, and then I get the free attack, so then I'll just have taken the turn I wanted in the end game already, right? Because he missed an attack, so it would be the same outcome. So I figured, maybe Maltz is better now if I play it immediately, but maybe it wasn't. I will also be honest, I haven't played that matchup a whole ton. I definitely haven't played against Duraludon with Eldegoss before, meaning I would have to keep my Pat in the matchup, right? Pat is something I would never bother with unless on the first turn of the game, right? So if it was not for the Eldegoss, I would always jam it at the time I did it, right? Because that's the only time it could be useful, but funnily enough, because he played Eldegoss, enabling all his bolts to be out of Roxanne at the end of the game, then the fight is really relevant at the end of it. Otherwise, you always jam the temple so that if he draws into double turbo, then he can't hyper portion, because then he can't attack, because the double turbo will only be worth the one energy.
Mm-hmm. Eldegoss in that deck is such an interesting thing. Because you always have so many ball cards because you need them for early game consistency because your deck's a potato. But then also,
exactly,
they're like still there, right? You just don't get rid of them once you set up. So it's, I don't think I'm bold enough to bring an Eldegoss and Arceus Duraludon, but it seems like a really cool choice.
Yeah, I think I admire that the pick of card as well. It seemed really cool. If you open with it, you can even shuffle it with a double turbo. So it's not the worst thing in the world, board state wise either. You lose a turn, but you can at least get rid of it to force the double VMAX still. So, I mean, I think it was pretty cool. It's also cool that you can combo it with Bird Keeper, so that if you're up against something silly that just blocks your Duraludon from attacking, right? Like Regieyes or Lapras, Paralyze or whatever, right? You can loop with Bird Keeper Eldegoss, so that gets you out of it.
Bro, why are you calling Lapras Paralyze silly? That's my favorite deck.
I mean, it's good. It's good, right? But it's silly from Duraludon's perspective.
That's fair. Are we going to see on Waterbox or NAIC?
Waterbox is cool, though. I like that deck.
I love that deck. It's not... so much fun.
It's really good. I tested a lot for Milwaukee as well. It just didn't play too well into Palkia, and that was annoying. So maybe if we can find some good way of solving that, then it would be more of an interesting pick.
The way I described it to chat, I played it on stream at the time, the day of recording. I played it in Amy's weekly tournament, and I was describing it to chat. It's the difficulty of Rapid Strike Urshifu, but the reward isn't anywhere near as good. I don't know if you would agree or disagree with that statement.
I mean, I guess it depends how it's built, because it's a box deck, right? So you can build it in a lot of different ways.
That's true.
But it really depends, though. It has a lot better Duraludon matchup than what Palkia has, that's for sure. You can crab that Duraludon to oblivion, and they can't do jack about it. All their healing cards are void, and they can't really do much. It's really fun.
The crab is amazing, especially against stuff that doesn't have healing. You Drizzile your opponent, and they're just like, what? And then the crab finishes off like everything in the format after that. It's so good. Speaking of NAIC.
Oh, yeah, it's super fun. It's really, really fun.
Speaking of NAIC, let's jump into a little bit about how we think the meta might be changing. Obviously, you don't have to leak anything that you don't want to, but I think the biggest thing moving forward is we already talked about Duraludon a bit. It got first. Blissey got second. Do you expect people to pick these two decks up? Do you expect them to see a greater amount of play at NAIC than they did in Milwaukee? Or is this going to be one of those things where people look at the results and say, that's cool, looks like an online tournament, and then continue on with their day? Like, how are you expecting people to adapt to those two decks getting first, split, and second place?
No, I think they will definitely see a little bit more play, because unless the deck does well in an IRL tournament, people don't really take them serious. But now it has, right? So now it's probably on a lot of people's radar of decks to consider to test, at least, right? But what has happened so far in the format is that every time decks do well, then they get countered like down to the ground in the next tournament again, and it's really hard for them to do much. So say in this case, right, I would expect to see both of the decks pick up a little bit more play, not anything crazy though, but a little bit more play, and then all the other decks will play hard counters for them and have answers, because no one wants to run into a mill tank and just call it a day, right, at NAIC. That sounds kind of silly. I don't think anyone will go into that tournament and say, hey, I will fold to mill tank. That's cool. So I would definitely think we'll see both decks be a little bit more respected going forward. But I don't think they will like take up the majority of the meta share in any way.
What about Mew? There was one Mew in top 8. And speaking of decks that like are quote-unquote respecting Duraludon and mill tank, it feels like Mew is that deck. Are you expecting people to come to that same conclusion? Or are people going to continue to shy away from Mew despite its obvious power level?
I mean, is there like a decent amount of Mew running around? There was a decent amount of Mew running around at Milwaukee as well, right?
I wasn't there. I don't actually know. I'm waiting for RK9 is going to release the meta share sometime in the next few days. They tweeted out, but I don't know it yet. So I don't know how much Mew there was or wasn't.
All right, fair enough. I saw a decent amount of Mew being played at the tournament and the day before. So I still expect Mew to be one of those like really good represented decks in the metagame. I also thought that it would do really well at this tournament because all the focus was on Palkia, right? But nothing had happened to Mew. Mew was still like on the same level as Palkia, you know? So it's out there. It's a really good deck, and whenever it's funny though, like whenever people like pick up Mew for the first time and start playing it, everyone says the same. Like everyone comes to the same conclusion. They say, "Man, this deck is broken. Why isn't everyone playing this?" That's like whatever everyone that picks up the deck for the first time says, right? So
yeah,
it kind of makes sense that it will always see a lot of play, like drawing 15 cards before your supporter and just being able to donk and like being able to heal. It has like all the tricks. It's in theory just the perfect deck. I guess the struggle it has is it's very targeted still. Less targeted now. There's more focus on Palkia. But it's still targeted. And you play a dump and draw engine, so you can draw the cards in the wrong order. And you can't really do that much about it. Like, if you draw two or three tablets in the first 15 cards, you are losing out a lot on the power level in your deck. And that's not your fault. You just happen to draw the cards in the wrong order. And now we're kind of stuck with the consequences.
So I need you to settle the long-term argument that's been happening for the last 3 weeks of this format. Who is favored, Mew or Palkia?
Well, I think it's pretty even, and it depends on the list both players run. But I think if you have the Pat and Roxanne combo in Palkia, then that's a win condition on its own, right? And it's also, like, thanks to Greninja, it's relatively easy to win in three attacks. If you, like, saw my last stream game against Rowan for the win and in, then I basically did the same thing both games. It doesn't always work as easily because your opponent can't put down Oricori, right? That will deny the snipe off of like Mew VMAX into Meleta, but even then you can still just like hit the Mew VMAX, then depending on what the opponents do, right? You can then either hit the other Mew VMAX or you can just Greninja right away and knock out the Mew VMAX and set up the other one. So that you can take advantage of like the almost knockout and instead setting up the other one for a knockout as well. So It's not too difficult to win in three attacks anymore in that matchup. And you can do it on either two VMAXs, one VMAX, one single pricer, or sometimes you can even do three double pricers. I played against a Mew in day two as well, where I did the three double pricer plan twice. So I just went like boss, boss, boss every time. I guess the first knockout was just sitting in the active and then have the boss even. So I just like boss twice after.
Okay, I was going to say, your list plays two boss. Can you tell me how you pulled off three bosses in a game?
I palpated one of the games. That was fine.
Oh, of course. That makes, yeah. I miss the palp.
But I think game two, I actually used boss three times in a row. I was promoting a record. Like, okay, boss. And boss again, palped. And then put on the final boss. I was, okay, oh, that works.
Are they going for the Psychic Leap plays?
Nah, they couldn't because I just bossed three times. So never hit into Mew VMAX.
Oh, that's gross. Okay, you were KOing Mews, not the Genesex.
Yeah. Like, you can knock out Mew as well. I think I knocked out one Mew that had a fusion energy, just so you can prevent the one shot. With Meleta as well. I always like to target down the fusion energy if I can to block the Meleta play.
Yeah, that's some of the best advice for anyone who didn't play Arceus in the last format, and I'm assuming Palkia is the exact same in this format. Any of these 280 HP V stars, KOing fusion strike energies early will help you so much.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what it's attached to. Just take the knockout on it and run. So.
Oh yeah, it's Oricorio, Genesect. It doesn't matter. You go get rid of a fusion strike energy so they can't OKO you with four of them on the field, and you will thank yourself later in the game.
Yeah, most players like aren't really thinking like valuing the fusion energy as hard as they could. So they often end up on a double pricer, which is your preferred target anyway when you start the boss game, right? So. If it's on a double pricer, then you have an easy time. If it's on a single pricer, you need to like wait it a little bit more, but you should usually target it anyway.
Except I guess the big one would be, and I've said this before on the podcast, I've said this on stream, I've said this on YouTube, Mew players, you don't have to KO a Sobble for 210 damage. Like, if you KO that Sobble with Melodious Echo for 210 and let me remove two fusion strike energies from play, I'm winning the game every single time. Please don't do that. Or do you do that? I guess it depends who you're rooting for.
Yeah, I mean, you would like that, right? So please do that if you want to help out Mello here. That's a thing as well, right? Even if you can't take a knockout, it's not always advantageous for your board position to do that, especially with Roxanne, who's talked about in the format right now. If you take that knockout on Sobol, that plays out into you taking knockout on Arceus, and then you get Roxanne patted into the ground again. So that might not be the best idea.
And last big deck for NAIC that I want to bring up is arguably the best deck in the format. I think you can agree with that. And it's just so underrepresented this last tournament. Regigigas. Did Reggie prove that it's just not good enough to hang after Milwaukee? Or is NAIC the chance for Reggie to take all 8 spots in top 8?
Well, the thing is, right, with Reggie is that it is really, really good, but there are a couple cards that you can jam into basically anything. That's really annoying for it. So it depends how many of those cards you expect to face, right? A big one is Collapse Stadium. That one's really annoying. Because not only do you need to find the Counter Stadium and a new Reggie, but you need to find the freaking Counter Stadium before the Reggie. So if you have a ton of ball outs, but not the Stadium yet in your hand, and usually like have to get the new hand, right, when you play Reggie, like Marnie or Research or whatever, then you need to find the Reggie again because you don't have that one anymore. So it's just such an annoying stadium to deal with. You also have Avery forcing you to find not only the active Pokemon, like the Reggie that got knocked out, but you also need to find 2 more that you had to discard off the bench again. Like, really digs into the amount of resources you have. So Avery is super annoying. Collapse Stadium, really annoying. Temple means that you can't even attack if you miss that Counter Stadium. So that one's also pretty rough to deal with. So you don't really enjoy stadiums too much, so you want to have a ton of outs for them in your deck. And then you also have stuff like Tool Jammer in Palkia. It basically guarantees that Palkia is trading evenly when it attacks. That was like one of the big reasons I played Jammer. Especially against the Reggie matchup, it's really good. On top of that, though, if you do play the Churl, as I did in Palkia, then the Reggie matchup is incredibly good because you can heal off the Palkia with the Jammer so that the Palkia with Jammer takes at least 3 prizes, and that's really good. That probably just wins the game.
That's not even counting Roxanne plus Sinnoh.
Yeah, that's not even counting that you have more ways to like scam them for a turn, right? So that's like a guaranteed 3 prize swing with that Palkia. Like, you're only really gaining 1 turn on them because of Roxanne, because like if they're spending 3 attacks and because you're Gerald, they're still getting 2 prizes. So like, you're getting 1 turn, but it's pretty easy to attack every turn, and 1 turn is huge, right? Especially if you were the one that attacked first. Like, Reggie doesn't always get that turn 1 attack off, right? I mean, it's kind of difficult.
No, if it did that, it would actually be probably a tier 1 deck. But I don't know what the consistency of the turn 2 attack is, but that's also not 100%.
Yeah, you start struggling if you miss the turn 2 attack as well, especially if your opponent went first. But if you went second, it shouldn't be that difficult because you get to support her twice, right? So you should often be able to pull off the turn 2 attack at the very least.
Should, yes, I agree.
I mean, you should, right? You don't always do it, which is the issue. But if you do, then you're doing pretty well. Then the deck usually just are able to cycle itself pretty well from there. But you still have all these annoying cards I spoke about. There's also a problem that like the deck isn't really dealing well with Arceus, with Unsparce and Charon. Because you can't one shot, and then they just heal each turn, and you don't have any good plan of attack. So that's also like another main issue the deck is dealing with. But the deck is really good against Palkia in general, especially untacked Palkia. that doesn't play Jammer and Cheryl. Otherwise, the matchup is like pretty good for it, I think. And then he's also really good against Mew. Mew doesn't have any great ways of dealing with the Regis either. They're really tanky. Psychic Leap is pretty hard to pull off against them. You need double tablet and no double turbo attached to Mew. So it's hard to shuffle. You get one shot. Everything you have in your deck gets one shot. And it's a hard time. You're only getting one prize and you're not playing much hand disruption or any awkward stadiums for them to deal with. So Mew is having a hard time dealing with that matchup as well.
So one last question for NAIC. I'm going to need a prediction from you. Do you expect that one of the decks that makes top 8 will be a completely unknown or unknown-ish deck? Or do you think everything in top 8 is going to be things we've already seen before, just slightly different?
Ooh. Will we see any new concepts, completely new concepts?
Specifically in top 8, not like, oh, someone's going to top 32 with, I don't know, I was trying to think of something. Yeah.
No. But top 8, right? Like run the whole gauntlet with something new they created in the bedroom, right? Yeah.
Last NAIC, we did see Spirit Tomb. I believe that was the last one, right? And the last one, wait, no. The last NAIC was won by a completely new concept. And that was the Checkmate.
Yeah. Yeah. That was
Stefan.
That was Stefano, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is that gonna happen again, or are you saying it's all gonna be stuff we've already seen?
I mean, it could happen, but my predictions this time is a no, actually. I definitely think we can see new versions of already known concepts, but My bet will be on no this time. I will maybe I'll change my mind on Thursday. I'll let you know. But
depends what you submit as your deck list.
Exactly right. No, I'm not that cocky. I wouldn't say that. I think we have a pretty okay defined meta right now. There's so many like tournaments and information being spread that there's definitely harder to come up with new concepts now, but it can happen, of course. But I feel safe for saying no this time.
Okay. I'm gonna take the yes. I think there's going to be something, maybe not absolutely ridiculous, but something that would have shown up as other on one of the Limitless tournaments is going to show up and be like, oh, wait, yeah, that's kind of cute. Okay, that works. I think this will be the tournament. This will be the one where you're like, it's not going to be like a groundbreaking, what an absolutely broken like Eldegoss loops type thing, but it's going to be something where you're like, oh, okay, that's kind of sick, actually. Good job. At least I'm hoping.
I know Sandra is coming. He's going to play some sort of control shenanigans. So if anything, it will be on him, I think. But I don't know. We'll see. I'm really looking forward to it, though. Like these big tournaments is always a blast, and people are putting a lot of effort into them. And I can't really wait to see what people come up with.
I can't wait either, Tord. I'll be rooting for you. I'm gonna be back in Washington, but I'll be sending you some good energy to take that dub and regain your title.
Awesome, awesome. Thank you so much. I'll try my best, you know.
Tord, if people want more of you, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter. That's just my name, Tord Reklev. You can also find me on Twitch. I'm streaming on TCG Park on Twitch 5 days a week or so. Less when I'm traveling. So a little bit less right now, but normally a lot. So you can find me there. And we'll be streaming in and talking, and we can hang out. And yeah.
And of course, myself, you can find me on Twitch, Twitter, and YouTube at @Mellow_Magikarp. This has been another episode of the Lake of Rage podcast. We'll catch you all next week.